Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey. Today's guest is a filmmaker, a health and science journalist, and a New York Times bestselling author named Max Lugavere. He's a son who watched his mother make all the right choices in life and still get early onset dementia and other health problems, decided he's going to go out and hack his mom. So he wrote a book called Genius Foods and has been a long time Bulletproof follower and friend. And Max, welcome to the show to talk about your new book, The Genius Life.
Thanks so much, Dave, for having me. I think the last time I was on was about 5 years ago when I was up in Vancouver at your lab. And I filmed you, remember, for Vice.
Yep.
That was a blast. So it's great. It feels like a homecoming in a way to be back.
Yeah, it's hard to believe it's been 5 years. So it's about time to have you back on. That was episode 229, where we talked about dementia, aerobic exercise, and breadhead. Which was a documentary you're working on. But you've come back and you've spent 5 years doing research and all, looking at areas where we both have a lot of interest, and listeners, I think, have heard a lot about this. But you looked at circadian biology and psychology and dementia and making brains work better, which we both care about, and you put it through the lens of how do we prevent dementia. So people who've read my book Headstrong know that I covered some of the topics that you covered in a different way, but you've gone deep on psychology and deeper on circadian. So I think there's some new findings here and some areas where we disagree, and I'm hoping to find somewhere we disagree so we can have a spirited debate about how you actually should be eating popcorn to fix Alzheimer's or something. That's your argument, not mine. Anyhow, welcome to the show, my friend.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's good to be back. I think it's, whenever you're talking to somebody who's as well-versed as you are, it's always great to have disagreements, because I think it ends up strengthening the science and you end up coming out ahead because you actually learn something. And that's ultimately what I'm in this for. It's to learn. It's to continue to expand my knowledge base so that I can live a healthier life and hopefully not have to contend with some of the conditions that my mom developed early in her life. So yeah, it's good to be here, and I'm excited to talk to you about my new book, The Genius Life.
It's amazing what that enlightened quest for self-preservation can drive us to do. I mean, a lot of the Bulletproof learnings were, hey, I'm tired of being fat and tired and in pain and all that. So you start to do it. And when you're saying, hey, this happened to my mom, I don't want this. Right, so how do I help my mom, and how do I, by doing that, help myself? And that's a very noble and very highly motivating thing that I think a lot of people don't recognize. It's okay to be selfish because, look, not dying is the number one drive of humans. So that's because all life forms have that. That said, we will choose to die if it's to protect our community or our children or to make a self-sacrifice. And that's why we really... what's the word I'm looking for? Award or just honor when someone decides that they're going to do that, because they overcame our most basic biological drive. So you and me, we harnessed our, I don't want to die and I don't want to suffer along the way. And then we're able to use that to help other people.
Yeah, so well said. I mean, I've been very lucky in that I've never dealt with any major medical concerns personally, but my mother, who is the person who I love most in the world, when I was in my mid-20s, my mom, who was about 58 at the time, began to show the earliest symptoms of what would ultimately be diagnosed as a form of dementia. Now, I think a lot of younger people thought that dementia was something that happens inevitably as a natural aspect of aging, or it's an old person's disease, or it's genetic. So those three misconceptions that I harbored, I learned very early on, were mistruths. So my mom was not old. She had all of the pigment in her hair. She was a youthful, spirited woman from New York City. And I had no prior family history of any type of neurodegenerative condition. In fact, dementia, when I thought about what dementia meant to me, I had seen an Addams Family movie in the early 90s, and dementia was the character that Uncle Fester actually had a crush on. So that's when I thought about dementia at the time, that's what that word evoked in my head.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
I forgot all about dementia and Uncle Fester, but yeah, I gotcha.
Yeah. So I was just completely ignorant of the condition. And when my mom first began to show these symptoms, it caught me and my family completely off guard, to the point that we actually didn't believe her at first, that she was actually struggling with her cognition, that her brain was actually in the middle of a crisis, and we mm-hmm. were impervious to it. So I ended up going with my mom to major medical institutions. We began the journey in New York City, which is where my mom was living at the time. And to see your mom begin to stutter and slow down, almost as if she had had a brain transplant with somebody 40 to 50 years her senior, I mean, it is the most surreal thing to witness. And so at a certain point, I realized that I had to step in and get involved. And I started going with my mom to these doctor's appointments. And we began in New York. And in every doctor's office, what I experienced, I've come to call diagnose and adios. Essentially, a doctor would try to come up with some kind of label that they would apply to the slew of symptoms that my mom was experiencing. But my mom had an atypical presentation of dementia. And so we actually didn't get a diagnosis until we went to the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. And it was there for the first time that my mom was diagnosed with a neurodegenerative condition. And she was prescribed drugs for both Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease. And that was the line in the sand for me. It was the first time in my life that I'd ever had a panic attack. And from that point on, I became dedicated to investigating why this would have happened to my mom at such a young age, and what could be done, if anything, to prevent it from happening to myself and others that I care about. And I didn't have a background in medicine. I didn't have a background as an academic scientist. I was a lay person, but I did have a background in journalism. And so I used the tools that I had harnessed working for 6 years for a news and information network to begin to look into the medical literature. And although it was tricky at first, I then began to exploit my media credentials to then reach out to researchers and experts all around the world. And so at this point, I've had a tremendous amount of exposure to the topic. I've been able to obviously write extensively on the topic. I wrote my first book, The Genius Foods, which is now published in 8 languages, and my second book, The Genius Life. But even aside from literature aimed at lay people, I've also been able to publish peer-reviewed literature. I was able to co-author a chapter in a textbook, actually, geared towards psychologists on how to manage people who are at risk for developing cognitive decline and dementia. So it's been a really, it's been a painful journey, but at least I've been able to sort of funnel some of the pain and frustration that I experienced with my mom into something that I feel is meaningful and ultimately able to help others.
Do you still get panic attacks?
You know, I have not really had a panic attack like the one that I had in that hotel room with my mom. And the best way that I could describe it, because I had never had one previously, it's sort of like when you have one, it's sort of like that scene in the movie Saving Private Ryan on the beach within the first 10 minutes of the movie, where all of a sudden, all of the noise, all of the dramatic music fades out, and all you hear is this high-pitched tone, and you see the guy holding his shoulder, looking for his arm on the beach. Mm-hmm. And like, you just hear that tone. You don't hear anything else. It's basically like, just where's my arm? What, you know, it's like, it doesn't even process that the guy has lost his arm. And that's what it feels like. And I haven't had one since, thankfully, but that really was the motivating. I mean, that was it for me.
It's one of those things, because in your book, you talk about psychology of all this stuff and all, and you know, there's a deep, there's a deep-seated thing that happens with panic attacks, you know, where it's pushing, you know, old automatic buttons in the system. And, you know, the definition of biohacking that's, you know, now out in the world is, you know, change the environment inside and outside of your body so that you have full control of your own biology. And, you know, part of that control is the psychological control. And in The Genius Life, you talk about psychology of that. And I'm sort of wondering, what have you learned around the psychological side of your environment and what that does to reduce panic attacks or just anxiety and stress?
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, one of the major topics that I advance in The Genius Life that I think is really cool, and I haven't seen it really mentioned by other health writers, and certainly not in other books, but this notion of cross adaptation. And I'll tell you why I think this is so important. So, you know, there are certain stressors that are inevitable. And we all talk about how we should minimize chronic stress and things like that. But there are certain stimuli that are just an inevitable part of daily life. I mean, think about what we're going through now all collectively with the COVID-19 pandemic, right? Certain things you just can't wish away. And so I think in those instances, what can really help you cope with stress is to become more resilient. So those are the two ways that you can deal with stress. You can either remove the stressful stimuli, or you can become more resilient to that stimuli so that it actually doesn't have the same effect, so that it doesn't actually stress you out. And I think that what I've worked hard to do over the past couple of years is to really boost my resilience to stress. And I've done that using a number of different modalities. But the reason that I've really focused on the resilience aspect of things is because my mom had a chronic degenerative condition. And ultimately, she passed away about a year and a half ago to another terminal illness. She was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. So my life over the past couple of years has been incredibly traumatic and stressful. And the only way that I could really deal with that is not to remove the stress, because the stress was always there. And I think a lot of people deal with stress. They deal with sick loved ones. They deal with financial stress and things like that. What I did was I decided to boost my resilience. And that's where cross adaptation comes in. So with modalities like physical exercise, with cold immersion or cryotherapy, or even heat stress with saunas, for example, what you can do is you can boost your resilience to and your acclimation to these physical stressors, which then has a spillover effect. And that spillover effect is called cross adaptation. So by adapting to the stresses imposed with exercise or with heat stress, you actually become more psychologically resilient, which I think is a very powerful and empowering idea. And this is one of the reasons why they're doing research now. And I think that they're seeing modalities like cold therapy or heat stress associated with dramatic reductions in symptoms of depression. Now, where would that connection lie? What would the mechanism there be? And I think that the mechanism is that you're strengthening, you know, your brain, and you're fortifying your mental health while you're fortifying your physical health, which is something that is it's not super intuitive, but I think very empowering nonetheless.
The idea of using heat stress and cold stress, and even hypoxia, lack of oxygen stress. Those are, you know, things that we do at Upgrade Labs, kind of core biohacking techniques. And we know that they make your mitochondria work better. We know that, you know, they can make your cells clean themselves out and things like that. What research did you find specifically around the psychology of those things, or around what they're doing to those mental states? I mean, are there studies that say depressed people take cold showers, they get better?
Yeah. There's a researcher named Charles Raison. I forget what university he's out of. It's R-A-I-S-O-N. And he's done a number of studies with sauna therapy. And he's showing that just using a sauna can have an effect at on symptoms of depression that is, I believe, something like twofold higher. It's twofold more effective compared to standard of care treatment, so pharmaceutical treatment. And the beautiful thing about that is that, you know, pharmaceutical treatment, although it is effective the more severe the depression, you know, these treatments are not without side effects. There have also been a number of case reports coming out showing that cold water swimming, so like winter swimming, is powerful as a therapeutic for depression as well. So both of these modalities, I think the science is you know, the story is just being written and it's continually evolving. But there is a signal in the literature that I think is beginning to emerge, where by exposing our bodies to physical stress, sitting in a sauna, cryotherapy, that it seems to really fortify mental health and to reduce symptoms of depression. Now, physical exercise, this has been well documented. So there have been a number of meta-analyses published over the past year showing us that whatever your exercise modality of choice is, whether it's aerobic exercise or resistance training, that it all seems to be effective in terms of reducing symptoms of depression, reducing symptoms of anxiety. For patients with just, you know, run-of-the-mill, mood swings, but then also with clinical depression as well. And I think that the same mechanism applies. I mean, exercise floods your brain with BDNF. It makes your brain more plastic. And we know that neuroplasticity is important for, it's an important means of, you know, helping your brain rewire. And so sometimes Boosting BDNF, which is the brain's Miracle-Grow protein, has been suggested as one of the mechanisms by which actually some of these pharmaceutical drugs do work in some patients.
It's
drugs like, yeah.
It's interesting because most of the psychedelics increase BDNF. You know, lion's mane mushroom is in some studies reported to it. I couldn't feel any difference from it. And then I found an Australian variety that I've talked about on the show before from LifeCycle that really seems to make a difference. Electrical stimulation over the brain raises BDNF. So there's all these different things, and all of them seem to help with nerve growth factor and BDNF, which is fantastic. In fact, there's a supplement that does 4 times more BDNF than exercise. But what I've never been able to find, even from that, the study about that, this is an extract of the fruit around coffee. It's called Neuromaster. It's one that I manufacture, or that Bulletproof manufactures, that I helped to create. The question, though, is in those studies with those claims, I don't know what kind of exercise they were comparing it to. And when you say exercise, what the hell do you mean? Because does this mean like, hey, you know, I'm going to lift heavy today? Or is this like, you know, I'm going to, you know, go run 500 miles and, you know, and all the things, jazzercise. Like, what does exercise mean in the context of BDNF? Because I honestly feel like there's a lot of like, kind of like kale. Kale's good for you. Like, actually, no, it's not. Like, maybe a little bit, whatever. But like, what really is exercise in the context of the way you think about it for the genius life? I mean, I have my answer, but I want to know your answer.
Yeah, so I'm actually not a fan of doing cardio. I don't really do cardio. I try to be more active in my day-to-day life. So one of the types of physical activity that I talk about in the Genius Life is non-exercise physical activity, which I think is crucially important. So this is actually not exercise, but this is just, you know, ranging from chasing your kid or your cat around the house to doing chores, doing laundry, even typing to some degree, just staying active. Like anything other than sitting on the couch and watching Curb Your Enthusiasm reruns is going to be good for the brain, because just moving, simple daily spontaneous movements, create microvacillations in your blood pressure that push fresh blood and nutrients and oxygen up to the brain. So that is like, that's like the base of the pyramid of physical awesomeness, let's just call it. So these non-exercise physical activities. When it comes to exercise, if you're doing a lot of non-exercise physical activity, then I don't think that you need to do cardio if you're not training for endurance purposes. If you are sedentary all day, you know, and there's a significant portion of the population that are, you know, essentially desk jockeys, then I think to give your cardiovascular system a workout once in a while, I don't think that that's necessarily a bad thing. I just think that there's probably diminishing returns. And at a certain point, excess cardio can lead to scarring of the cardiac tissue. It can negatively affect your joints. And I personally find that running is compressive on my lower back. So I have low back issues. I don't actually like to run, but I will occasionally do an elliptical. And, you know, to be honest, as much as I dislike doing cardio, speaking anecdotally, when I spend an extended period of time being sedentary, which, by the way, we know that being sedentary literally drains blood from your brain, I actually tend to find myself that I develop headaches when I'm sedentary for an extended period of time. And for me, going to the gym and doing a little bit of cardio, 10 to 20 minutes, again, this is an anecdote, can actually make my brain feel a lot better. Now, where I really put emphasis is resistance training. And I might have a bias for resistance training because I just grew up very interested in bodybuilding. It's just something that I, you know, as a teen, I became sort of interested in. But I think that the research really seems to be coming out by the day, validating that resistance training not only has been underappreciated in the literature, especially where the brain is concerned, but I mean, growing stronger, bigger muscles, one of the best things that you could do for metabolic health, to reduce inflammation, to continue to be mobile as you age. And we know that age-related sarcopenia is a real thing. I think having more muscle, more strength on your body can't be underrated. I mean, if you think about just the mere fact that having more muscle means a greater ability to dispose of glucose, I think right there makes it worth getting to the gym, you know, just for that reason alone. Your body has a very limited capacity to store sugar. In terms of its ability to store sugar, your body's like a New York City apartment. There's just not a lot of places to cram the glucose that most of us are consuming you know, with every meal. So your liver can store about 100 grams. Your musculature can store, you know, 300 to 400, 450, depending on how big you are, how much muscle you have. But for your average American who's consuming 300 grams of carbohydrates every single day, I think it's important to kind of take note of the fact that, like, that is where we are able to store sugar. And so to have those banks and then to use the sugar regularly with resistance training or high intensity interval training, it's going to, I think, be a reasonable way for most people to kind of make room for the sugar and the glucose and the starch that inevitably is going to find its way onto people's plates.
All right. So the bulletproof recommendations totally line up, right? So extensive cardio is just not good for you. There's a couple studies that show extensive cardio may lengthen telomeres, but there's other ways to do it. Superhuman, I read about, you know, a peptide, it's $50 you can inject. There's supplements, there's sleep, there's all kinds of things. So unnecessary and comes at a great cost. In Game Changers, I talked about 80% of people who start running end up injured in the first year anyway. And there's another law in Game Changers about how chronic pain and injury sucks energy all the time until you deal with it. So it just seems like the ROI is low. If you're saying, I'm going to, quote, get healthy. And there's a little bit of emotion for me in this because when I weighed 300 pounds, I went on a low-fat, low-calorie diet, and I started exercising an hour and a half a day. And lo and behold, 18 months later, I still weighed 300 pounds. I could max out all the machines at the gym, but my joints were worse, and I'd actually done harm to my health from this. So this idea that I'm going to get healthy, so I'm going to, you know, go plant-based and I'm going to go run all the time, it's actually like slapping yourself in the face. It isn't the way that your body responds. So we fully agree on that perspective of chronic cardio isn't going to do it. We agree on high-intensity interval training. We agree on some amount of weight training. What's the right amount of weight training? How many days a week?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, I definitely have an ear to the ground when it comes to fitness and what the research on just fitness, you know, like what we get from some of our top exercise scientists. And I think it really depends on each person. But the more adapted you are to resistance training, I think the more you can do, like the higher, you know, the intensity that you can stand. And in fact, the higher intensity you need to continue to grow and to get stronger. So it's this concept of progressive overload. So whether it's volume or intensity, you know, I think, with increasing fitness, I think you have an increasing work capacity, and, you know, I think that's really what you've got to build your workout routine around that, where you are in terms of your own personal fitness. So for me personally, I've been hitting the weights for a decade at this point, if not more, almost two decades. And so I feel that I can, you know, go to the gym 5-6 days a week, and so long as I'm sleeping properly, I'm not consuming alcohol, I'm consuming enough calories, enough protein, I feel like my body is pretty amenable to that level of work. And it allows me to maintain a good body composition, a body composition that I'm happy with. And, you know, all of my blood work is, you know, near optimal for at least what I can remember in recent, and, you know, over the past couple of times I've done blood draws. And it allows for this without me having to obsess over macros and calories and things like that. Now, I think if you're first starting out, then you want to build an aerobic base. And you don't have to do cardio to do that. I think you can do that doing resistance training. You also want to establish muscular control, stability, and things like that. Because as you mentioned, people who just jump right into these workout routines, and especially running, they end up hurting themselves within the first year. So I think it's going to be different for every single person. But generally, the recommendation from, you know, from at least from the American Academy of Neurology, which recently updated the guidelines because they determined that exercise can be a powerful disease-modifying treatment for mild cognitive impairment, it's about 150 minutes a week. So that's generally that's the general guideline. Try to get 150 minutes a week of some kind of exercise.
All right. My recommendations there were 20 minutes of movement a day And then twice a week, high intensity interval training is the minimum necessary. So it's less than 150, but not that far off, because 20 minutes times seven is, you know, 140 minutes. It's just, is it really exercise if you're going for a walk? I don't know.
No.
It isn't. Yeah, however, for that 150 number, I think it counts. It's that idea of movement versus true exercise. You know, do you have to be on a treadmill going fast, or is just a walk okay? It seems like a walk's okay.
Well, yeah, there's different, like, I mean, I think that that's where you really ought to do kind of all of the things, because you're working out different energy systems for one. So when you're doing high intensity glycolytic HIIT training, you're working out, you know, your phosphagen, you know, energy system, which utilizes creatine. You're working out your glycolytic pathways. But then the more low and slow movements, which I really love, like walking, as you said, you're oxidizing primarily fat. It's not necessarily a cardio workout. It's not resistance training. But you know, it's great for your cardiovascular system. It's great for, mobilizing lymph fluid around the body and for pushing blood up to the brain. So that's why I think it's important to, the non-physical activity is a crucial, that's like sort of the base of the pyramid. I think resistance training is crucial. High intensity interval training is crucial. And you can kind of do them in a way where your resistance training could have a cardio aspect to it. You know, like your heart rate is definitely going to increase, but you know, it depends on your goals. There was a great, I was listening to a lecture recently by Pavel Tsatsouline, who's like this world-renowned strength coach. And he was saying that, you know, if your goals are to put on purely strength, then you can stand to have longer rest periods in between your sets. But that's not necessarily going to give you the cardio workout that you're going to get with a more circuit-like routine. So I think kind of balancing all of those teachings for your goals is important. But at the end of the day, ultimately, over the course of the week, you want to get a little bit of cardio, you want to get the resistance training, you want to do some high-intensity interval training, and just generally, you want to be sedentary as little as possible.
It's time for a tough question, though. It's easy to talk about exercise and all that stuff. Are you actively dating someone now?
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
It's time for a tough question, though. It's easy to talk about exercise and all that stuff. Are you actively dating someone now?
I'm not actually, but I'm looking.
All right. You just put the word out there. There's only like 500,000 of them listening right now. I just want to post your phone number. I'm kidding. But I mean, you are apparently, I've heard from a few women, an attractive man. Mostly because of the tussled hair that you've got there, Max. So you've nailed it. But I do find that single guys are like, yeah, 5 days a week in the gym is good. And this also, I'm guessing, I already know this because we're friends, you don't have kids.
Don't have kids. I do have a cat that I share with my little brother, and she's sort of like she's a fur baby. But
got
no,
it.
I don't have kids. I don't have a girlfriend. So
yeah, it starts. So I would have had similar answers when I was single, or even heck, when I was dating, right? You know, it's pretty easy if you have, you know, two adults and you're like, oh, look, we share a place. I'm going to go hit the gym. You want to come with me, honey? And like, it works. But then all of a sudden, hey, do you want to watch, you know, our offspring? Well, I go to the gym, and it's like, actually, no, I'm too tired to watch them, and I'm too tired to go to the gym. So I find that in phases of life, it goes from this, yeah, 5 days a week. I see very few people who are raising families and have careers who can go to the gym 5 days a week. I mean, Tim Chang from Mayfield, who I've been friends with for like 25 years now, I think, something like that. He's actually pulled that off, but he's still spending, you know, 90, I think somewhere around 90 minutes a day on that stuff. But he's, you know, general partner at a big VC, and somehow he's managed his life. So he has, you know, kids and portfolio companies and enough time. But I mean, I work on that. I live in the middle of nowhere. I don't work out 90 minutes a day. I don't think it'd even be good for me if I did. Maybe 45 minutes a day if I'm lucky of some biohacking. What else do you do like on a daily basis? How much time do you spend between all these things? Saunas. Oh, there's 30 minutes of your life gone. You got to take a shower. Make that 45 minutes. Some red light therapy. There's another 25 minutes. Like, so how many hours a day do you really spend on, being youthful?
That I'm so glad that you asked. And you're right that I'm pretty privileged that I don't have a ton of personal commitments that I can really focus on this. But I will say that, and this is going to sound a little cliche, but when they say in an airplane, you got to put your mask on first before you, should offer help to those around you. I truly believe having gone through something that is as stressful, if not more than something that anybody will ever experience over the past year, that what kept me sane throughout what I experienced with my mom was the fact that I was able to, and that I forced myself ultimately to take at least a half an hour every day to do some kind of exercise. Now, you don't have to go to the gym to do this. You can do body weight exercises. I actually, just before things got really crazy with the COVID-19 thing, I went and I got some workout equipment for my house. And it's not an extensive amount of equipment. All I bought two kettlebells. And you'd be surprised with what you can do with two kettlebells.
Did you get the pink ones?
I didn't get the pink ones.
No. Oh man. I've been looking at some of those pink ones, man. Those are the best ones. Kidding. I always laugh. For some reason, if they're 5 pounds, they're always pink. And it turns out 5 pound kettlebells are really useful for a lot of exercises, especially if you're using blood flow restriction. I always just laugh. I just wanted a normal looking one. I didn't want it to look like some sort of, way overpriced, zombie face or something. I just wanted a kettlebell and just like a plain old metal one. I guess I'm too, I'm too plain. All right. So you got a couple of kettlebells. What do you do with them?
Yeah. Well, I mean, so just to close the loop, there's a lot, a lot of the pathways that get stimulated when you're sitting in a sauna, for example, also get activated during exercise. So heat shock proteins. So I'm sure you've talked about heat shock proteins. I talk about it in my book and the fact that they have this ability to act like a buttress against other proteins in your body that may have a tendency to misfold and clump and aggregate and form plaques like amyloid beta or tau, which are the two proteins that kind of characterize the pathologies that we see in the brains of patients with Alzheimer's disease. When you're doing physical exercise, high intensity interval training, resistance training, you're basically, and you're elevating your core body temperature, you're activating those same proteins. So you don't have to do it all. I think it's important to take a triage approach. And at the very top of that hierarchy, I would say that, just in terms of the evidence, the level of evidence, physical exercise really should be the one thing. Of course, prioritizing sleep, that is crucially important as well. But everybody generally blocks off a third of their day around to sleep every night. And we can go into ways of improving your sleep, which is another topic that I cover in The Genius Life. But generally, in terms of the things that you can will yourself to do every day that are going to have an entourage effect, a spillover effect, where it's going to be the tide that lifts all the boats in your harbor, I think that doing physical exercise, committing to a half an hour a day, is going to really give you the most bang for your buck that you can wish for. And it's going to improve all of the other aspects of your life. So it's going to improve what you're able to give to your loved ones, to your job. I wouldn't be where I am professionally or personally without exercise. I do it primarily for my mental health and for that cross adaptation effect. And with the kettlebells, what I do is I have a really simple routine. So I just have two kettlebells. They're not even very heavy. They're about 18 pounds each. And I'll do a circuit because, of course, I'm working out at home now, where I'll alternate shoulder presses with some bent over rows, with some push-ups using the handles of the kettlebells. And then I'll do some lunges and some squats. I'm not like a big kettlebell like enthusiast, so I don't know the appropriate names for all of the different moves. But you can get a legitimate full body workout with kettlebells, and they don't even have to be that heavy. You just do as many reps as you can.
Yeah, they're solid, and the set of stuff you're doing there, it that works, and it hits all the core muscles. Probably the kettlebell swing, you probably know that one. It's good for your dating life, if nothing else, because there's there's a hip thrust there that's probably useful. But you're standing, you swing the kettlebell between. But what it does for your butt and for just your whole back, I definitely am a fan of the kettlebell swing just for core stability and strength. as well as some shoulders. And then, do you know the Turkish get up?
I don't know how to do that, actually. I've never done one. I have low back problems, so yep. It's kind of like...
You can't swing then, yeah.
Yeah, it's a little bit... Sometimes I'm comfortable swinging, but it's not always predictable. Like, my form, I think, is very good, but sometimes I can't predict, and sometimes I'll be doing it with great form, and there's just a little bit of pain. But the Turkish get-up looks very interesting. I haven't tried that yet.
Yeah. Hit that up on YouTube. I mean, there's all kinds of videos for it. But that one's, I don't do it regularly, but I got into it a few years ago, just as I was looking at the most efficient, effective kinds of exercise. And by the way, newsflash, it's blood flow restriction or electrical stimulation or using non-gravity-based feedback are the ones that give me the most returns on investment. But the Turkish get-up, you probably could do with your bad back. But you're basically like starting out on the floor and holding it in a certain position as you get up off the floor. And man, that pushes buttons in the body that nothing else does. So I got to say, for anyone listening, if you have a kettlebell, you're stuck at home because of the whole virus thing, man, maybe that's your way to do what Max is talking about here and get your exercise in.
Yeah. Home workouts are important, especially these days. And, you know, the link between exercise and mental health really can't be overstated. You know, and when I'm home for an extended period of time, it really is a challenge mentally. And I think this is a lot of people. I think this is actually one of the things, one of the topics that is being under covered in terms of the media, what this social distancing collectively is doing for our mental health. I mean, I have a younger brother who works from home. And he is used to being in isolation and working from home and having all of his relationships and his work contacts communicate with him digitally. But for some people who are not used to that, I think it could be a challenge from a mental health standpoint. So anything that we can do to fortify our mental health during this time is crucial.
I've been seeing people do like workouts together over video conferencing systems, which is kind of funny. It's, you know, okay, let's like, you know, 10 friends together, let's all do whatever. But it does do something pretty cool. And I did with some of my really close friends, we did like a virtual dance party, like we would do at New Year's Eve or at Burning Man or something. And that was actually kind of fun and also ridiculous because we're all like at home by ourselves, like, you know, whatever. But it does something good psychologically, I would say. So there's something there in having just adequate exercise. I can't imagine staying locked in a place for 2 weeks, sitting on the couch and not moving. Like, you're just going to feel like garbage when you're done.
Yeah, couldn't agree more.
Let's move on to another topic. And this is one that's super near and dear to my heart. One of the reasons that Bulletproof made collagen a thing is that it's very high in glycine and the amino acid that's there. And in Superhuman, I go into like a ton of detail about how aging cysteine and methionine are, and like one of the reasons that you restrict protein at certain times of life is that it's not necessarily all protein, it's protein that has too many of certain amino acids. What did you learn during the course of the Genius Life about methionine and glycine in ratios, and what are your recommendations there from the book?
Yeah, so I mean, think, you know, people tend not to talk about glycine because it's not technically an essential amino acid. It's conditionally essential, though, and research calculations estimate that we need about 15 grams of glycine daily for good health. And glycine makes up 1/3 of collagen protein. And I have no affiliation with any collagen manufacturer, but I'm actually a big fan of collagen. And I try to get it from bone broth, from collagenous, you know, tissue. I try to practice nose to tail animal consumption.
Have you ever eaten an animal nose? Have you ever actually eaten a nose?
I've never. No, nor have I eaten a tail. But
the nose is pretty tough to get down, man. The little nostrils like that. Because I run a farm. I get the whole animal, and I got to say, there you should make that one into sausage. I just got to tell you. Okay, keep going. I was wondering. Most people are like, I've never made a nose. I'm like, no, I have, and I only did it once.
Wow. Yeah. So
I'm not going to throw up in my mouth right now.
Well, I do think I'm interested in that whole. There's a lot. There's this belief that like benefits like. So if you eat parts of an animal, like say cow brain, that it's going to be good for your brain, and it would make sense that cow brain would be full of DHA fat, phospholipids and things like that. I don't know so much about nose, like how eating nose would benefit your nose, but
it's just the collagen cartilage tissue.
Yeah.
But I mean, the cow brain thing, it actually is profoundly good for your brain, except it has all sorts of weird viruses and prions and things like that. So
prions, yeah.
Yeah. Historically, I wouldn't. Tricky. I don't eat cow neurological tissue or any animal neurological tissue right now, other than maybe fish or shrimp or something.
Yeah, that makes sense. Maybe because the mammals, you know, like avoid the mammal brain. So I mean, there is a suggestion in the literature. It's been primarily performed in animal studies with rats, but that rats when on methionine enriched diets, they have a shortening of their lifespans. And that shortening seems to be abolished when they add glycine into the mix. In tandem with that, there have been studies that have shown that mice on normal diets, so not necessarily methionine enriched diets, but they're able to live significantly longer by 4 to 6%. So it's not a huge amount, but it's something that achieved, you know, it's an amount that achieved significant statistical significance when given glycine as well. So it seems that glycine has sort of this longevity imparting effect. And mechanistically, glycine is there to buffer methionine. And when we consume too much methionine, like, you know, the person who, for example, is, you know, take the omnivore who eats only lean chicken breast, right? Like the omnivore who is only eating like lean chicken on their salads. And that's the bulk of the meat that they're consuming.
They're screwed up.
Yeah. I mean, that person, and by the way, that's how my mom consumed. My mom was a reluctant omnivore. She primarily was vegetarian, but she would only eat muscle meat occasionally because it would give her protein. And, you know, so that's what she would eat. Generally, it was always lean chicken breast. So what that person is doing is they're maximally raising their needs for glycine while getting very little of it. Your average omnivore consumes about 2 grams of glycine every day. They synthesize another 2 grams. But as I mentioned, we might need about 15 grams for good health. So, and the other issue is that an omnivore who's primarily eating muscle meat and not getting adequate glycine, and then is able to balance their glycine with either a free-form glycine amino acid supplement or collagen protein, they're basically achieving what a vegan is able to achieve. So a vegan is actually, there are many problems with the vegan diet, and I would never endorse it from a health standpoint. But the one thing that a vegan diet probably does have going for it is that it's fairly balanced in terms of methionine and glycine. So if you're an omnivore,
It's low in both, isn't it, though? Just like minimizing glycine, but where are they getting, or minimizing methionine, but where are they getting glycine as a vegan?
You can find small amounts but they're also getting very low methionine.
I think it's that they crank their methionine way down, but they're also, I would say, then deficient in glycine, which is why you see so many vegans get injured within a year of going vegan. I mean, one of our family friends, I'm going to go plant-based for my health. I'm like, that ain't going to work. You know, 3 months later, you know, both knees blown out skiing for the first time in 20 years of skiing. Like, well, what do you know? You didn't feed your connective tissues now, did you? Right? Like that kind of stuff does happen. And it actually happened to me too when I went vegan. You know, all this crazy joint pain. And you hear this all the time from vegan athletes. Oh, I spend so much time rolling because I'm in pain. I'm like, yeah, try some glycine, right? I.e. collagen. And that's why for me to restore myself, I went heavy on the collagen. I still tell everyone, do 20 grams of collagen a day. I mean, we're one of the largest manufacturers of it now. Because it's such an important thing. It's when people go on the vegan recovery diet after they've caused the damage from that, it's like you got to get some saturated fat to build your cell membranes. You got to get some glycine and just some collagen to rebuild your connective tissues that I think get exhausted from this because your body needs glycine for antidepression, right?
Yeah, glycine is also a neurotransmitter. I have a theory. It's also rate limiting in the synthesis of glutathione, which is the body's master antioxidant. My hypothesis is that you're also accelerating aging by not getting adequate, glycine, and you're also not giving your body the proper ingredients that it requires to effectively detox. So a lot of people are spending lots and lots of money on detox teas and things like that, but actually collagen, glycine might be one of the most effective detoxifying, foods or supplements that you take, especially if you are an omnivore and you're, you know, consuming maximal methionine without balancing it with glycine.
In fact,
so, yeah, from an anti-aging standpoint.
In fact, one of the things that most people have never heard of is something called methylglycine or methylated glycine. And you can get this stuff through, it's called sarcosine, and it's been trialed for depression. So it's one of those quasi drugs. It's a natural compound, but you can take it and it lasts in the body way longer than normal glycine does in the brain. So you can prop up your glycine levels using this stuff. It's fascinating. And if you dig into the research on it, you just realize, wow, glycine is doing something in the brain. But your book, you're talking more specifically around, hey, methionine and maybe cysteine are making you old. And glycine is the way to balance that out. Plus you need it for your brain anyway. What's the difference in your mind between a glycine amino acid supplement and just taking collagen?
That's a good question. I actually do have both, and I was taking free-form glycine prior to bed because there have been a few randomized control trials that show that about 4 to 5 grams of glycine prior to bed can actually boost sleep quality and efficiency. And so I couple that sometimes with magnesium, which has also been shown about 500 milligrams every day can boost sleep as well. And so I feel like both of those two together, it's sort of like a sleep boosting, anti-aging, super powerful combination. And I would just do the free-form glycine in part because glycine, actually, if you've never had free-form glycine, it's very sweet. It literally has a mouthfeel and taste almost like sugar, not quite sugar, but I would just do that prior to bed. And the reason for that is that you need to consume in one teaspoon of pure glycine, you're getting, I believe, 4 grams of 4 grams of glycine, 4 or 5 grams of glycine, and you would need to take 15 grams of collagen protein to get that. So it's just a more efficient way of jacking your glycine.
It is, and in fact, the original "Hey, take collagen before bed" sleep hack, I wrote that almost 10 years ago, and it's just been echoed across the internet like so much. It's pretty crazy. Bulletproof just came out actually with a specific collagen sleep drink that you put before bed. And you can take straight glycine as the amino acid. I just feel like the collagen di and tripeptides, these are little tiny bits of pre-digested collagen with enzymes. I think they have other benefits in the body, which is why I still go down the collagen route. But the mechanism of action that's likely there is partially glycine, and it may have something to do with serotonin, according to Steve Folks, who's been on the show to talk about it. So there's merit to that. And then magnesium is interesting because I've also had that in, you know, the original sleep hacking posts and everywhere online and all over the place, even the Reader's Digest, like magnesium for relaxing. But I came across this intriguing research about the circadian nature of magnesium. And so I still take magnesium before I go to bed. And my numbers are a little higher. I think people need at least a gram of magnesium a day, but you can't take it all at once. But it turns out you have the highest magnesium at noon. So because you use it in your mitochondria to make energy, well, okay, that means I moved at least half and a little bit more than half of my consumption of magnesium to the morning. So I take that when I first wake up, I'm along with all the other stuff I take on an empty stomach. And then I take it again at night for sleep. And I found I got much better results by having it twice a day. So I could hit that intraday peak for energy and metabolism. And then I could get it again at night for relaxation, the way you're talking about. And it's fascinating because, you know, timing on all these things matters. And there's almost no research on the circadian nature of when you should take glycine or any other supplement. But we know glycine before bed or collagen before bed, that seems to work.
Yeah. And I think from a psychological standpoint as well, people like to kind of build their supplement regimens around various time points in the day. You know, we like to ritualize our utilization of these tools. So the morning ritual, the pre-bed ritual. And that's why I think it can be very effective actually anchoring our usage of these supplementations to a specific time point so that we don't forget. And we all wake up in our homes, right? We all have access to our kitchens in our homes in the morning and before you go to bed. So it just makes it, I feel like it makes it easier from that standpoint. Although, you know, I'm sure there are some people out there like you who carry around 45 supplements in their pockets with them wherever they go.
I do carry 45 supplements, at least per meal, to get a total of 150 a day. But there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, except that it's expensive, and you have to manage all that stuff. For me, the benefits are absolutely worth it, but I also have weird goals and weird biology going back and just going back in time, having been obese and all that stuff. So I'm willing to do it because I don't know how to, you know, be CEO of Bulletproof and write books and do the podcast. And actually, I should say be chairman of Bulletproof. I hired a CEO finally. But all of those things just take so much time and energy. If I didn't take my supplements, I didn't get my, you know, focused quality sleep and all the things that are part of managing, well, what we're calling a genius life in this interview, but just managing your biology. I don't know how to show up as a dad and do all the other stuff. And as a husband, I don't think I would. I don't think I'd have the biological energy to do it. So I appreciate you getting the word out in your book about the stuff that, you know, that really, really matters and the stuff that you found works for you and looking at the research, which is also really important.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the benefit of having written books, you know, I think, you know, for me, just speaking personally, I'm not a clinician, so I don't have the ability to iterate in people's diets and then to see them in 6 months and to see how my recommendations have fared. But because I have the benefit of having had some time passed between now and my first book, Genius Foods, you know, I can tell you I've gotten thousands of letters from people all around the world telling them that my recommendations have helped them sleep better. They've achieved healthier mm-hmm. body compositions without having to obsess over the scale or ruin their relationship with food. And now in the Genius Life, I've taken the same approach, but towards all the different areas in people's lifestyles where they're going to be able to make small tweaks that cumulatively are going to add up to big health wins. And I've tested them on myself, and I don't want people to believe that because it works for me, it's going to necessarily work for them. But I've taken an approach that I think is pretty evidence-based, but is not necessarily evidence-bound. I think that, you know, circadian biology is like, we're just writing the first chapter now of how our biologies interact with light, how they interact with food, how food timing and how light timing can affect our health in pretty profound ways. And that being said, even though the story continues to evolve and does so at a, you know, breakneck pace, I think that we have enough data where we don't necessarily have to sit idly on our hands. We can take action today that, in accordance with the available evidence, is going to help reduce our risk for some of the kinds of conditions that are really burdening modern society, and where our tools from the standpoint of medicine are pretty limited. And so that's where I think it's great to be able to kind of have a research-based perspective. And to be able to put this information out there for people, because, you know, I mean, if you look statistically, people are just not well. I mean, we're now on track by the year 2030, one half of the nation are going to be obese. And you know, I mean, you've dealt with problems related to your weight. It's a hard pill to swallow. But I think all it takes for most people are a few simple insights and a few simple tips to really turn things around in a powerful way.
Well, I appreciate writing the book and doing the work and just living the lifestyle, because it really does change things. And when you can lead by example, it just adds a level of credibility to your work that a lot of people, you know, are striving for. So thanks for being on the show again, Max. I look forward to seeing you in person the next time we're allowed to travel.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests.
This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.